Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
We all remember our childhood birthdays, a kind of second Christmas when you were made to feel special. As we grow older, birthdays can inspire a degree of nervous reticence as we seek to avoid paying too much attention to our passing years. These days, I do enjoy sharing the joy of my grandchildren as they clock up their formative early years. It's not often that you get to celebrate a 450th birthday, but I did just that when, as ambassador in London, I was invited to attend Shakespeare's big birthday bash in Stratford some years ago. As the most senior envoy in attendance, I'd been asked to propose a toast to the local bard on behalf of the diplomatic corps. The roster of seven speakers at the bard's elaborate lunch included the novelist Hilary Mantel, who told me about her Irish heritage and of her desire to set a novel in Ireland, which, alas, was never written. As the last speaker, I was wary of being the postprandial diversion for an audience that I knew would by then have been generously plied with good wine. But when the cocksure individual who spoke just before me managed to go on for 30 minutes without even a mention of the venerable birthday boy, I began to hope that my brief remarks might come as welcome relief to the gathered Shakespeare devotees. I recognised that I might be an odd choice to celebrate such a quintessential English icon. But then again, to quote something President Higgins said when visiting the Royal Shakespeare Company during his historic visit in 2014, we Irish were the first people outside of Britain to enter into dialogue with the English language. That makes Shakespeare an indispensable figure for us too, one who has inhabited our imaginations for centuries. He continues to fascinate us with his beautiful phrases, his insights into the human condition, and for helping us, in the words of another English writer, to see into the life of things. My own initial Shakespearean exposure came at the age of 14, when Henry IV Part 1 was part of the syllabus for my intercert. I still remember with fondness the antics of Prince Hal and the roguish Sir John Falstaff, and can recall many lines from that play. I know you all, and will a while uphold the unyoked humour of your idleness. And, while you live, tell truth and shame the devil. Good advice, that. At our wedding in India in 1982, I recited Shakespeare's Let Me Not to the Marriage of True Minds Admit Impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Let me hasten to add that I also recited Yeats's fine wedding-appropriate poem, He Wishes for the Clouts of Heaven, Tread Softly Because You Tread on My Dreams. Yeats, our national bard, saw Shakespeare as an artist who presided over the birth of a new species of man. And James Joyce was obsessed with Shakespeare. The characters gathered in the National Library in Ulysses, all highly knowledgeable Shakespeare enthusiasts, indulged in a deep, dense discussion of Hamlet. Joyce even refers to the possibility that Shakespeare might have been Irish, but alas, our genealogists seem to have drawn a blank on that score, for now at least. In Finnegan's wake, Joyce pays Shakespeare the ultimate tribute of including him in his holy trinity of literary idols, Dante, Gouty and Shopkeeper, a.k.a. Dante, Goethe and Shakespeare. When his friend Frank Budgeon asked Joyce which book he would take to a desert island, Joyce replied, I should hesitate between Dante and Shakespeare, but not for long. The Englishman would get my vote. Writing to mark the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, our great playwright Sean O'Casey commented that he loved all things, he missed nothing, for nothing was too lowly for him to touch, with a beautiful phrase. The English language may have been acquired by the Irish as a byproduct of conquest, but today it's something that we share with huge numbers of people all over the world. And that's why, on that day in Stratford-upon-Avon, I was happy to pay homage to William Shakespeare, the first man of literature, treasured property of the world of words. I will almost certainly never attend another 450th birthday, but will be happy to celebrate my own 70 in the coming months in the company of my family, and there'll be no need for speeches. But I will probably call to mind a poem Yeats wrote around the time of his 70th birthday. What then, sang Plato's ghost, what then? The work is done, Grown old, he thought, according to my boyish plan. Let the fools rage, I swerved in naught, something to perfection brought. But louder sang that ghost, what then? What now? Time, perhaps, to sail to Byzantium, metaphorically at least, and mull over, in Yeats's words, what is past, or passing, or to come.
It was 11 o'clock in the morning when we pulled into the little square in Custuriaco and parked in the shade of a tamarisk tree. Stepping out of the air-conditioned car and straight into the hairdryer heat of a Cretan morning, we glanced around, trying to get our bearings. The drive from Paliahora had been beautiful, and the last 10 kilometres or so up the perpendicular narrow trail truly breathtaking, in every sense of the word. Now here we were. Custuriaco, a tiny village with a noble history, and perched more than 500 metres high in the majestic White Mountains. I'd first come across the name Custuriaco when I'd read The Cretan Runner, George Sikondakis's extraordinary story of the Cretan resistance during World War II, when the author himself had fought side by side with war hero and famous writer Patrick Lee Fermor. The stories of Nazi brutality in Crete are legion. I'd heard so many war stories over the decades as I returned again and again to visit this lovely island. The robed, grey-bearded Orthodox priest who strolled the streets of Paliahora in the mid-80s had been, so the story went, the head of the local resistance. Then there was the old man who ran a caffinion, a cafe, situated right on the bend as you headed south out of the town of Kandinos. Deutsch? He asked me tentatively, the day I visited with my father in the early 90s. No, we said, Irish. And then, upon discovering that my father had fought with the British in North Africa, he fell upon him like a long-lost brother, before taking him through to the kitchen to show him a framed certificate on the wall from the Allies, recognising his services during the war. Kandinos, of course, had been obliterated by the Germans. Some hurts truly never heal. Over the years, however, as I learned more about Crete's war history, I had been drawn to the story of Custuriaco and its famous Patarakis brothers, and to one incident in particular. This is what happened. In reprisal mode in 1943, German troops swooped into the village and, finding the men dispersed to the mountains, rounded up all the women and children, herding them into the square to face a firing squad. As the commanding officer was about to let rip with the machine gun, a shot rang out, and he fell, slain, in the square. Then, as the gunshots rained down, the execution squad fled from the village. The shots had come from the men who had gathered on the high cliffs above Custuriaco, and it was Kostas Patarakis, one of the 6 legendary Patarakis brothers who had fired the fatal shot. Kostas, Manolis, Georgios, Vardis, Adonis and Vasilis, all are legends of the Cretan resistance, the Patarakis name still whispered among the elderly, like some kind of a sacred incantation. It was Manolis Patarakis, after all, who played such a vital role in the famous kidnapping of General Kruipe, later the subject of the film Ill Met by Moonlight, starring Dirk Bogarde and our own Cyril Cusack. Wow, I remember thinking when I first read about Custuriaco. Just imagine being in the village square that day, sure that you were facing certain death, only to be saved at the last minute, and by one of your own. Reading about it was one thing. Actually visiting the place was another. And now, on this hot summer's morning, I was here at last. We had stopped at the war memorial at the entrance to the village, and now, in the village itself, we thought we'd stretch our legs and get a cup of coffee. We looked towards the run-down caffinion on the square. An old man was sitting on a chair out front, fingering his worry beads and pulling on a cigarette. The cafe door was closed and chairs were upturned on the tables inside. Nothing doing here. Then we noticed the women, all elderly, sitting sewing together under a shady umbrella of trees. They smiled. We smiled back. Then one of them, like a petite little bird, set down her sewing, hobbled to her feet and waved us over. She shook hands with me and then with my husband. "Café?" she asked. "Yes," we said, "that would be great," as we looked around for another caffinion that we must have missed. She waved to us to follow her. Out of the square, down a narrow street, turning right into a dirt-covered track, and along to the end we strolled, before she opened a gate and in we went, finding ourselves in a beautiful garden. It was her own house. Indicating for us to pull up a couple of chairs to the small table there, she bustled off into the kitchen. A few minutes later, out she came with a box of biscuits and a steaming pot of coffee, and there we sat, the three of us, sipping, silently, in the sunshine. I tried to ask her about herself. Her name? Sophia. Was Kustoriako her home village? Yes. Had she lived here since she was a little girl? Yes. Was she here then when the women and children were taken into the square by the Germans, I asked, when the men of the village were on the cliff top? There was a lot of sign language going on, including me pointing back to the village square and using my fingers like a gun. She nodded. Yes, she'd been taken to the square that day. A teenager, I guessed, judging her age with my eye. I followed her into the kitchen to help bring more coffee. Inside her small, tidy house, there was a huge black-and-white photograph on the wall. A man. A handsome man in his late 30s. Maybe his 40s. I pointed to my own wedding ring, to her, and to the photo on the wall. Yes, she nodded, and then her eyes filled with tears, as overcome by the memory of her now-dead husband, she tried to control her emotions. Back out again in the sunlit garden, my husband asked if he could take her photograph. She smiled and nodded, reaching out her hand for me to join her in the picture. "I'll send it to you," my husband told her afterwards, trying to explain that he needed her name and her address. Yes, she understood that, and so, drawing herself up to her full, tiny height, she proudly declared, "Sophia Patarakis, Crete." When you're the widow of one of the legendary Patarakis brothers, I suppose that's all the detail you'd ever need.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do. I took my gun and vanished. I have changed my name so often. I've lost my wife.
It was a small but heavy glass candle holder in the shape of a star. I pushed it up against the prayer to St. Peregrine Laziosi, patron saint of malignant growths, and I lit the candle. It wasn't my candle. In fact, I'd never lit that candle before that night. It was my mum's. She'd been diagnosed with cancer. I don't think I knew it was cancer at the start, but in 1989, no one said that word. She was sick for months. There was only the three of us, her and me and my dad. And Mum decided she wanted us to go on the diocesan pilgrimage to Lourdes in May. We weren't sure she'd be fit for it. And Mum said something quietly to me about last family holiday together, but I think I ignored that and kept on talking. And May came. I was doing my finals in university and it was decided I was better staying put and studying. So I didn't go. On the Thursday, I left Mum and Dad off at the car park where the coach was leaving from. Dad in his usual shirt and tie. Her in her brown velour tracky bottoms, her sick woman's trousers, as we used to call them. And as the coach pulled out and headed for Dublin Airport, I went back to student life in Belfast. Meanwhile, they arrived safely in Lourdes and reported back that there was great colour in the town because of the huge numbers of uniformed soldiers and sailors from around the world on the international military pilgrimage, which happens at the same time. So they spent Friday down around the Basilica and the Grotto and sent a few postcards to family. On the Saturday, though, Mum took sick, and by tea time, she'd deteriorated. I came back down to Newry. Dad was on the phone. I'd never heard him crying before. And that's when I lit the candle. And I waited. And the phone rang again about 9:30. And Dad said, "She's not good. Drive up to Belfast and stay with your uncle tonight. Don't be on your own." And I thought, well, I'll leave the candle and I'll let it go out on its own. And then I was concerned that it would catch fire, so I lifted it and I put it in the sink, still lit. I grabbed some clothes upstairs, came back into the kitchen, and then I thought, oh, our neighbour's going to see this wee light flickering in the house. He'll know it's empty and he'll be worried. So I looked at the clock, blew out the candle, jumped in the car and drove to Belfast. My uncle came out to his gate as soon as I got there and he hugged me and he said, "She's gone." So I started making the calls, family, friends, arrangements, funeral, local undertaker. "Sorry to hear about your mother. Where's the family plot then?" "I don't think there is one. The old graveyard maybe." "I never heard any talk about it." "Okay then, new graveyard, new plot. What size of plot do you want? A single or a family?" "Family's for three, single's for one." "Can you have a double?" "No, you can only have three or one." Now I'm 20 at this stage. "I don't know, can't decide." "What I'm trying to say to you, son, is, are you thinking of living around the town yourself?" I laughed to myself. It was decided that Mum's coffin would be sealed before it left Lourdes. So it was in arrivals in Dublin Airport where all those joyful Christmas reunions take place and Irish sporting heroes returned to flashbulbs and cheers that I first saw my dad, and he was just broken. We waked her in our house. People came whom I didn't know because she'd done something for them that they wanted to remember. And there was great comfort in that and happiness and laughter about things she'd done or things she'd said. All those rituals that we used to take for granted, that eased and perfumed the process of death and grieving. But I never saw her. And that's hard. Still find that hard. The last memory I have of my beautiful, kind and gentle mum is her getting on a coach in a car park in Newry, heading for Lourdes and not even looking back, thinking her own thoughts just on her own journey. The funeral came and went in a blur and all of a sudden we were two, me and my dad. Two people who rubbed each other up the wrong way at the best of times and couldn't speak about the unbearable loss that they'd both suffered. I felt like we were like a tricycle that had lost a wheel, and a trike with two wheels is kind of unstable and unpredictable. Months later, a package came from France with the death certificate. And I went through it, cause of death, place of death, time of death, and I sat in our living room and I wondered, what was I doing when she died? 10:45 p.m. But of course we were an hour behind. And then I felt the hair stand on the back of my neck as I realised she'd passed away at 9:45 Irish time, precisely when I looked at the clock and blew the candle out. Her candle. There's an official framed group picture of them all with the Dromore pilgrimage and it's faded and yellow now. And you can see my dad squinting into the sunlight in front of the Basilica and Mum gazing off into the distance, just unaware of the photographer, in her own world. I'm told by people who were there that Saturday night that she'd heard the lured hymn drifting in through the hospital window from the candlelit procession, and it was all very calm and very serene. And out of all the postcards that they sent to friends and family the day before she died, the only one that never arrived was mine.
It was an English woman who first mentioned her. The girl, who had arrived at Lake Arrowhead as the nanny of a rich family from New York about to vacation near our modest cabin, sounded like Mary Poppins. To top it all, she was reading Pride and Prejudice. I was 8 years old and asked this grown-up, who must have been all of 19, what prejudice meant. She never even tried to explain, but did mention the author's name, Austen, sounding to a child brought up on westerns the same as a city in Texas, one as mythic as Fort Worth or El Paso. Only Jane Austen, who died aged only 41, was neither an outlaw, adroit gunslinger, nor a settler. And she spelled her name with an E, not an I. The childminder loved the Regency fashion and gave me sketches of bonnet-wearing women and high-waist dresses. The gentlemen favoured lofty top hats and tight breeches. These people attended balls, not barn dances. I forget her name, but realizing she had a rapt audience, me, the nanny read out passages from the novel in her cool, for us, novelty English accent. Austen's characters are talkative, and that first encounter introduced lots of lively exchanges and a quick-witted, smart-talking heroine called Elizabeth, who had four sisters. A house full of daughters had left the father depressed, and the poor fussy mother an indiscreet slave to her nerves. An eligible man was viewed as both prey and godsend. It soon became obvious that this was far more interesting than Little Women and closer to Kill a Mockingbird. In common with Scout Finch, Lizzie, or Miss Eliza Bennet, inhabited a small town community in which social ritual meant more than simple kindness, and everyone spent their time moaning about money when not gossiping about each other and noting the slightest telltale gesture. Each face was described and their personalities were revealed by their words. It was great, almost as funny as Dickens and Sharp. I discovered irony and loved it. Imagine being able to think like Elizabeth Bennet, deliver your opinions with such fierce eloquence, and openly vow to marry for love. In Austen's Mr. Darcy and Captain Wentworth reside studies of repressed men battling their emotions, especially rejection and disappointment, using surface coldness in letter writing. Reading Austen inspires lifelong devotion. She predates the psychological realism of the 19th century Russians. Think of poor Tatiana and Eugene Onegin, or elsewhere, of the heroines of Thomas Hardy or Henry James. We think of Jane Austen, youngest child and second daughter born in a rector's family of seven children, as a shrewd commentator working from a corner in a parlour. Although marriage, or rather a financially sound marriage, a social survival for a young woman, is among her major themes, Austen was never to marry. As a schoolgirl, she had written Wild and Subversive Juvenilia. Three volumes were published in the 20th century to the amazement of Austen scholars. In them, women drink too much and men are forced to set traps to ward off their female pursuers. Then, nothing. After years of silence, she resumed writing. Between 1811 and 1817, then in her 30s, she completed six novels, Sense and Sensibility, Pride and Prejudice, Mansfield Park, Emma, Northanger Abbey, and, so tellingly, darkly, Persuasion. Her brilliant grasp of comic, at times merciless satire, and timing was apparent as early as Sense and Sensibility, and triumphed in Pride and Prejudice as well as in Emma, which showed Austen was sufficiently confident to create a snobbish heroine with very real flaws, who cruelly, if thoughtlessly, insults the hapless Miss Bates. Austin was ever alert to vulnerability, not just his scene with Miss Bates, but also most perceptively in the pragmatic Charlotte Lucas, who admits to marrying the odious Mr. Collins for security. "I'm not romantic," she says to Lizzie. "I ask only for a comfortable home." Elizabeth's initial regrets about rejecting Mr. Darcy are heightened when she views his estate Pemberley in all its glory. The practical, clear-eyed realist Austin was a confirmed battle-scarred romantic. She had to have been. How else could she create Anne Elliot in Persuasion? At 19, Anne had been joyfully in love with Frederick Wentworth, who adored her, yet all is destroyed by the well-meaning interference of Lady Russell, who attempts to guide her in the absence of her dead mother. The romance is destroyed. Anne must endure the snobbery of her appalling, spendthrift baronet father and her equally revolting older sister. Meanwhile, the youngest Elliot, Mary, has married beneath her into the Musgroves, mere gentry. Anne lives with her regrets. Wentworth reappears, a success, if embittered, in search of a wife but distant to her. Her emotional pain is extraordinarily astutely drawn, as are her efforts to regain Wentworth. Bright, clever, 20-year-old Jane Austen had herself fallen in love over Christmas 1795 with Limerick law student Tom Lefroy. Parted from Jane by financial circumstances, Lefroy became a lawyer, married well, and his wife inherited further wealth. They had 7 children, the second a daughter named Jane Christmas, the period during which Jane and Tom had flirted and danced, as she told Cassandra, her sister. He lived on until 1869, dying aged 93, a Lord Chief Justice of Ireland. He had attended her funeral, bought at auction a publisher's letter rejecting Pride and Prejudice, and admitted in old age to having had a boyish love for Jane Austen. David Noakes states in his 1997 Austen biography that she loved Tom Lefroy. Speculation suggests she suffered from Addison's disease. Yet Jane Austen, feminist icon, witty, intuitive, sardonic, and hurt by life, may just possibly have died of a broken heart.
Recently, I was rereading Shakespeare's take on the 7 ages of man, and it got me thinking, as I assume it's supposed to do, on my own life. But that life hadn't fallen comfortably into 7 cycles. At least, not yet. Instead, as I jotted down the landmarks of my own time, my life seemed to fall into 6 phases of 12 years, rounding out nicely at 72. Though, of course, I'm hoping there might be another rotation to come. The first 12 years are peppered with the concerns of childhood. Moving house at 5, making new friends, being forced to move school at 10 because of a teacher who was more than fond of using his fists and boot as methods of education. Seeing my brother and sister disappear to boarding schools, leaving me effectively as an only child. Heading for a 3-month winter stay in the Gaeltacht at the age of 11. A bleak but worthwhile journey. Leaving primary school behind and heading in great trepidation to boarding school in Limerick, where, for a time, I walked in my brother's imposing shadow. The second phase found me settling into the enjoyment of secondary school and making lifelong friends, enjoying their companionship, starting college and again feeling lost, isolated and out of my depth before becoming involved in student politics. Spending summers working at hotels in London, a city which offered free theatre, free concerts at St. Martin in the Fields and the entertainment of Speaker's Corner on Sunday mornings. Later, there was the challenge of a teaching career in my hometown and marriage at the age of 24. By the time I was 36, I had 2 children, had left my teaching job for broadcasting. Why would you leave a good, permanent and pensionable job for work in radio? My father had asked, and then added, that radio thing won't last. I had bought my first home at a time when such a thing was not only possible, but expected. But there had been losses too. My mother had died, as had friends from college and young people I'd taught in the vocational school in Castledermot. Suddenly, the world seemed a more shadowed place. At 48, I was looking, like everyone else, at the millennium, waiting for the world collapse that never came on that midnight hour. And again, my life had changed unpredictably. I had moved house, then moved and moved again. I was trying to rebuild relationships with my children. The realization had dawned in my working life that whatever else I wanted, it wasn't a managerial role. And the possibility of a full-time writing career was rolling around in my head, parading itself as a possibility. At 60, I looked back on all kinds of changes. The loss of a beloved brother, the step out of the permanent and pensionable had happened, to be followed quickly by the realization that life as a full-time writer is mostly impossible and only very occasionally imaginable. Part-time lecturing in Maynooth University was keeping the wolf from the door. But there were other positives too. I had made the leap into theatre, writing, acting, directing. Books were being written. And though the car had 785,000 miles on the clock, life was at last what I wanted it to be, fulfilling and rewarding. So here I am, rounding out the sixth stage of my life cycle at 72. The last 12 years have brought the joy of new love, a mortgage, stepchildren, open heart surgery, and the accompanying shoulder taps from mortality that seem inevitable in the wake of such a medical adventure. But it has brought too new friends, new books, new places to visit, new voyages, and, to my delight, the health and enthusiasm to continue teaching and writing. Would I change any of it? Probably not. The light and shadow have provided me with food for thought, material for books, ideas for plays, and a constantly deepening knowledge and awareness of who I am, and who I still might be. And do I look forward to a possible seventh age? I do, sometimes, on days when the sun is shining inside and outside my head. But the six lived ages have taught me two things. To be grateful for all I have, and to be wary of presuming on what lies around the next bend. I am here, I am now. Those are the only certainties I have.
Mistress mine, where are you roaming? Oh, stay and hear your true love's coming.
Urbi et Orbi. It was Christmas, or maybe Easter, when the national broadcaster beamed Giovanni Montini into our kitchen. We knelt with our mother for his blessing in front of the new television. Our father stilled the rolling of the screen while we waited, the red linoleum soft under our knees, the cold of the old floor blocked by cork underlay, praying for the static snow to settle, the Vatican balcony to appear, and the third pontiff of my life so far to raise his hand and chant the holy words. Father marvelled that a blessing could travel from Rome to Balasque on waves of electricity. We shushed him and held our plastic rosaries aloft, beads missing, small crucifixes chewed, our faith firm in the power of flickering images, greedy for the magic rays from a Pope's right hand.
On this morning's selection of new and recent archive miscellany scripts, we heard Shakespeare and Plato's Ghost by Daniel Mulhall, the legendary Patarakis Brothers by Rosalind D, The Candle was by John Toll, Her Broken Heart by the late Eileen Battersby, Cycles by John McKenna, and Urbi et Orbi, a poem by A.M. Cousins. The music was The Clots of Heaven, sung by Eleanor Shanley, accompanied by John Feely and Adrian Mantu. The Partisan was by Leonard Cohen. In Pardisum, from Fauré's Requiem, sung by the Choir of the New College, Oxford, conducted by Edward Higginbottom. Sicilian in E-flat by Maria Theresia von Paradis, played by Jacqueline Dupré on cello with Gerald Moore on piano. And O Mistress Mine from Shakespeare's Twelfth Night, sung by Susanna de Rickson with Conor Lenehan on piano. It's a composition by Conor Lenehan. And that was recorded at the annual Arena RTE Short Story Competition Awards Night in the Pavilion Theatre in Dún Laoghaire. This year's competition, in honour of Francis McManus, is currently open for entries. And you can find out more at rte.ie/writing. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.